You're listening to ESL Podcast English Cafe, number 541. English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 541. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Visit our website at eslpod.com. Download this episode's learning guide, an 8 to 10 page guide we provide for all of our current episodes that gives you some additional help in improving your English. Take a look at our ESL podcast store with additional courses in business and daily English. And why not like us on Facebook? Go to facebook.com/ESLPOD. On this cafe, we're going to talk about a famous American actress of the 20th century, Mae West. We're also going to talk about Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley and his poison squad. Sounds mysterious. And as always, we'll answer a few of your questions. Let's get started. Mae West was born in August of 1893 in the Brooklyn neighborhood of New York City. New York City, you may know, is divided up into five major sections. They're called boroughs. She was born in the borough of Brooklyn. Mae West's mother had wanted to be an actress, but her parents didn't allow her to. They didn't give her permission to do that. So instead, Mae West's mother began making clothing. Mae West's father was a boxer. A boxer, B-O-X-E-R, is a professional fighter who uses his hands to hit the other fighter. In modern boxing, boxers wear gloves. They don't hit the other person with their hands, although there are some forms of boxing that do that, where the boxers don't wear any gloves. Of course, that's how people fight out in the street or in a bar. If you do that, the police will arrest you. But if you put on gloves and go inside of a special area called a ring, R-I-N-G, well, people will pay to see you do that. In any case, it was clear from the time Mae West was a small child that she had a talent as an actress, and her mother supported her dreams because, as sometimes happens, parents will support the dreams of their children, especially when they are dreams that they themselves had once wanted to accomplish or carry out. In 1901, when West was only 8 years old, she began acting and a few years later joined a national vaudeville show. Vaudeville, V-A-U-D-E-V-I-L-L-E, was a very popular kind of show in the late 1800s and early 1900s in the United States. It had lots of different actors and actresses who would perform songs and dances and do other kinds of entertainment for people. This was before the days of television and movies, of course, and a long time before Facebook. Wes toured the country with this vaudeville show until 1911, when she made her debut in a Broadway show in New York City as a singer and dancer. A debut, D-E-B-U-T, is when an actor, a musician, or other performer goes out and does something for the first time in public. So if a movie actress is starring in her first movie, we might say that she made her debut in the movies in this particular film. Mae West made her first performance, or had her first performance, in a show in New York City in 1911. It was her debut in a Broadway show. Broadway is a street in New York City where there are lots of famous theaters. Mae West continued to be a performer in New York City, on Broadway, we would say, for about 15 years until finally she wrote her own show. Now, this was extremely controversial, as you will guess from the title of that show, which was simply the word sex. Mae West also produced the show. To produce, P-R-O-D-U-C-E, can mean a couple of different things. It can mean simply to make. But when we're talking about a play or a movie or a television show, to produce means that you get the money to have the show made. Here in Los Angeles, there are lots of people who are producers. They go around and they get the money and they organize a particular production of something, a particular making of a film or of a television show. To be a producer, you either have to have money or you have to know how to get money from other people. Well, Mae West produced as well as wrote her first show called Sex. It would be the first of many in which Mae West would talk about the topic of sex. We have to remember this was in 1926 when most entertainment was not focused as it is today on this particular topic. And so there was a lot of controversy about it. In fact, when West began performing the show, the people who wrote about the show in the newspaper, the critics, didn't like the show. It wasn't a very good show. However, because of the topic, it sold a lot of tickets. Eventually, the police decided to come in and arrest Mae West and some of the other people involved in the show because this sort of play and this sort of topic was not considered legal to perform at this time. She was arrested and brought to jail, and eventually she was convicted of a crime. To be convicted, C-O-N-V-I-C-T-E-D, means for a court of law, a judge and a jury typically, to say that you are guilty of committing a crime. In this case, the crime involved corrupting the morals of youth. To corrupt, C-O-R-R-U-P-T, means to change someone or to influence someone in such a way as to make them worse off morally or ethically. To corrupt someone means to take someone who is otherwise innocent, otherwise good, and make them bad. Morals, M-O-R-A-L-S, refers to our ideas or beliefs about what is right or wrong, what the right way is for people to behave. Well, Mae West was convicted of corrupting the morals of youth, of young people, by these ideas that she was talking about openly in her play. Now, she actually didn't go to jail for very long. She only spent 8 days in jail, but she got a lot of publicity, a lot of newspaper articles written about her. Everyone was talking about her, and of course that made her even more famous and allowed her to become even more popular. This is often the case even today. Someone who isn't a very good writer or director or even actor does something that everyone talks about, and suddenly this person becomes famous even though they don't really have all that much talent. Well, Mae West did have talent as an actress, and she continued to produce plays and write scripts. By the late 1920s, early 1930s, it was obvious to people in the entertainment industry that the future of entertainment was going to be not in New York and Broadway, but in Hollywood, making movies. And so Mae West moved to Los Angeles, my fair city, and began acting in movies. From 1932 until 1936, she was in several movies, including Night After Night, She Done Him Wrong, and I'm No Angel. These movies were very successful, and West became an international acting star. She also became somewhat of what we may describe as a national sex symbol. A sex symbol, S-Y-M-B-O-L, is a famous person who's known for being beautiful and for being very attractive. Sex symbols in nowadays are usually Hollywood actresses or models. Well, Mae West was a Hollywood actress and considered a very beautiful and attractive woman. In fact, in the movies, she usually played characters who were considered attractive and who were very sexy, we might say nowadays. Mae West was very popular during the 1930s. She was in her 30s, but as so often happens with beautiful and attractive actresses here in Hollywood, as they grow older, they become less popular and their place is taken. They are replaced, if you will, by younger actresses who then become the popular stars of the day. That's sort of what happened to Mae West, although she continued to act in movies up until the 1970s, but she was never as popular as she was back in the 1930s when she was younger and considered a sex symbol. Nevertheless, Mae West is still remembered by Americans as being a sexy actress, and also one who became famous for some of the things she said in the movies. She would often use jokes that were based on some sort of sexual theme. She would say something, but it would have two meanings, and that double meaning would often be a sexual one. Part of the reason, no doubt, that Mae West became so popular is that it was rather unusual during this period to have such open displays of sexuality and discussions of topics that were not normally considered appropriate for the movies and public entertainment. Now it's impossible to watch a movie or a television show without those sorts of topics becoming the center of everything. But in Mae West's day, that wasn't the case, and that's probably one of the reasons why she became one of the first national sex symbols. Mae West died in 1980 at the age of 87. If you're a Beatles fan, you might be interested in knowing that her image appears on the album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And if you're a fan of art, you may know that the surrealist artist Salvador Dali made a sofa that was based on Mae West's lips. So she has some other importance in popular culture besides her acting career. The second topic of our cafe today is not one that most Americans know very much about. I certainly didn't before looking into the topic. It's the story of a man by the name of Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley and his poison squad. Poison, P-O-I-S-O-N, is something that either exists naturally or is created that can cause people or animals to die or become very sick if you eat it or if it gets into your body. The word squad, S-Q-U-A-D, refers to a small group of people who are put together to do a specific job or task. Nowadays, you'll mostly hear the word either in sports to refer to a group of athletes, or when describing a kind of police car, what we call a squad car, which is the normal kind of police car that you see that has lights on top of it and has the word police on the side. That would be a squad car. Here in Los Angeles, I don't know if it's still the case, but the squad cars were always black and white, and that's true in many American cities. People sometimes refer to police cars as black and whites because those are the colors the car is painted. Well, here, we're not talking about police or athletes. We're talking about a group of people who had a very specific job at the Department of Agriculture. Agriculture, A-G-R-I-C-U-L-T-U-R-E, refers to the science of farming and of growing food and raising animals. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is responsible for the laws and regulations about farming and raising cattle and animals in the United States. Our Dr. Wiley worked for the Department of Agriculture way back in the late 19th century, in 1882. Wiley became interested in the chemicals called additives that were being used in food to either change the taste or appearance of the food, or more often to preserve the food so that it would last longer in the store, so that it wouldn't go bad, it wouldn't spoil, for example. To spoil, S-P-O-I-L, when referring to food, means that the food changes in such a way that you can no longer eat it. If you take a piece of meat and you leave it out on your counter, out on your table in your kitchen for several hours, well, the meat could spoil. It could go bad so that if you eat it, you would get sick. Many times, companies that make food will put things into the food that will allow it to last longer so that you can keep it longer. Sometimes, however, these additives cause problems, and Dr. Wiley was concerned that some of these additives, these chemicals that were added to food, were actually going to be dangerous to people. For the first 20 years, he worked at the Department of Agriculture. He tried to get Congress, the part of our government that creates or makes laws, to have a law that would regulate additives that were used in American food. To regulate, R-E-G-U-L-A-T-E, means to make rules or laws that control something. The food industry, the people who made food, however, were not interested in these new laws and regulations, and they had a very strong lobby. A lobby, L-O-B-B-Y, is a group of people or organizations or businesses that work together to try to affect the laws that the government creates, or in some cases, to stop certain laws from being created. Lobbies are very powerful forces in American politics. There are many millions of dollars that are spent by different groups, business groups, political groups, consumer groups, all of which try to influence the laws that are made by the national government or by state governments. The food industry, the businesses that made food, had a very strong lobby in Washington, D.C., a group that tried to convince Congress not to regulate their particular business. In 1902, however, Wiley was given $5,000 by the government to do experiments about food that related to these additives. An experiment is a scientific test to see whether something is true or not. Wiley created a team of 12 young men to help him with his experiments. These men were all selected because they were honest, or so they thought, and had good morals. They would give an honest opinion of things. These 12 men agreed to work with Wiley on his experiments for 1 year. During that time, the men would eat every meal together, and the meal, the food, would be cooked by a special cook, a special chef, who would add different amounts of these food additives to the meal. Well, you can see now where we get the term poison squad. In this case, the squad was this group of young men who were eating this food as part of the experiment to see what additives, what things that were added to the food might be poisonous, might actually make people sick. It's not the kind of squad I would want to join, but these 12 young men did it, and every week they were tested to see if they were healthy or were becoming sick from the food they were eating. Sometimes the amount of additives in the food would be increased, and that would make people sick. Sometimes they would change the additives and see if that had any effect on the men's health. At first, Wiley wrote reports, sent them to the government, but the government just ignored him. They didn't do anything about it. The food companies, with their lobby, prevented any changes. Eventually, however, some newspapers got interested in Dr. Wiley and his poison squad, and they began to write articles about it. Of course, it was the newspapers that gave this group of men the name Poison Squad. No one would want to sign up for a group called the Poison Squad. Dr. Wiley certainly didn't come up with that name, but the newspapers wanted an interesting name that would get people's attention, and it certainly did. Newspapers began to talk about these experiments, and people began to get interested in them. Finally, in 1906, Wiley was successful in getting some laws created about these food additives. The government created something called the Meat Inspection Act and the Pure Food and Drug Act. An act is just another name for a law. Both of these laws meant that people who made food would need to follow certain regulations about food safety and about the sorts of additives that you could put into the food. This eventually led to what we now have in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration. The experiments of the Poison Squad ended in 1907. Wiley left the government in 1912 and took a job with a very popular magazine called Good Housekeeping Magazine. He died in 1930 and was pretty much forgotten, but it was his experiments that led to some of the first laws in the U.S. to try to protect people from dangerous additives in their food. And that's the story of Dr. Harvey Washington Wiley and his poison squad. Now let's answer some of the questions you have sent to us. Our first question comes from Federico, F-E-D-E-R-I-C-O, in Italy, of course. Federico wants to know the meanings of three words, real, actual, and true. All three of these words have multiple meanings, so we won't be able to go through all of the definitions, but I'll do my best. Let's start with real, R-E-A-L. Real refers to something that is actually existing or actually happening. The opposite of real in this sense would be imagined, something that is made up, something that you invented. Sometimes a movie is based on or comes from real events, things that actually happened. Sometimes the story is imaginary. Someone just invented the story, dreamed up the story, we might say. Real can also be used to mean the opposite of artificial or fake. You can buy a belt or a purse that is made of real leather. You could also buy a belt or a purse that's made from artificial or fake, F-A-K-E, leather. It looks like leather, but it isn't real. Some actresses in Hollywood have parts of their body that are real, and others have parts of their body that are not real, that are artificial, that were put there, but were not part of the body that they were born with, shall we say. Real can also mean important or something that we should take very seriously. Someone may say, we have a real problem here. That person means we have a serious problem here, a problem that we have to pay attention to. The word actual, A-C-T-U-A-L, can also mean real. It can also be the opposite of imagined. How do you know when to say real and how do you know when to say actual? Well, many times you could use either word to mean the same thing. The difference in use is probably related more to the context, to the situation. If you expect something to be imaginary, if you expect something to be not real, you might use the word actual to emphasize to someone that, contrary to their expectation, this is something that really happened or actually happened. For example, if you were watching the television show The Simpsons, which is a cartoon program, basically, and you said to someone, you know, the people on this show aren't just imaginary, they're based on actual people. There you would expect that the people in the cartoon would be just imaginary characters that the author invented, and then you find out that they're based on actual people. The expectation is that they would not be real or based on real people, but in fact they are. So the differences there are kind of subtle, kind of small. It depends on the context of when you would more likely say real or when you would say actual. In most instances, either word would be acceptable. The word true, T-R-U-E, usually means the opposite of false. Something that is true is something that matches the facts, that is in agreement with reality. It is true that Sacramento is the capital of the state of California. It is true that 2 + 2 = 4. It is false that Los Angeles is the capital of California. The most common use of true, then, is the opposite of false. There are some cases, however, when we use true to mean the same as real or actual. The most common case of the use of true in this sense would be with the word story. This is a true story. This is an actual story. This story really happened. It is based on something that is real. You may see an advertisement for a movie based on a true story. That means that this story is actually something that happened. It's something that took place in, we may say, real life. One other use of the word true would be as an adjective to describe something or some person who has all of the expected or necessary qualities of this particular thing. For example, he is a true artist. That means he has all the qualities or does all the things that you would expect a good artist to do? Our next question comes from Reiko, R-E-I-K-O, in Japan. It regards the meaning of the word lunch, L-U-N-C-H. Lunch, you probably know, refers to the meal that we eat in the middle of the day. We talk about breakfast, which is what you eat in the morning after you get up. Lunch, which in the United States is eaten usually around noon, 12 p.m., and dinner or supper, which is eaten, depending on where you live and the family you're in, somewhere between 5 and 8 o'clock in the evening. There's a related noun to the word lunch, which is luncheon, L-U-N-C-H-E-O-N. A luncheon usually refers to a meeting or a group of people who get together and have lunch together as part of a celebration or perhaps as part of some sort of organization's meeting or business meeting. The word lunch normally doesn't have an article in front of it, at least an indefinite article. We don't use the word a in front of lunch, typically. We say, I'm going to have lunch with my brother, or I'm going to have lunch at McDonald's, or I will have lunch at 11:30 in the morning. We wouldn't say, I'm going to have a lunch. We would not say, I'm going to have a lunch with my brother. However, sometimes the word lunch is associated with a meeting or an event, what we would also call a luncheon. With the word luncheon, we do usually use the word a. I'm going to a luncheon, because the word luncheon refers to this specific event. I'm going to a luncheon for my company, or I'm going to an alumni luncheon, a meal that will have other members of my college class there. We may also refer to that sort of luncheon simply as a lunch. I'm going to an alumni lunch. I'm going to a business lunch. In that case, someone may refer to a lunch without the word business or alumni or whatever particular kind of event it is. And so you may hear a lunch in some sentences, in some cases, when it's referring to a luncheon, a more formal event, a meeting of a group of people. However, in most cases, the word lunch, just like the word breakfast or the word dinner, is not used with the indefinite article a. Finally, Guillermo, G-U-I-L-L-E-R-M-O, in Spain, wants to know the meaning of the expression to put your shoulder to the wheel. Your shoulder, S-H-O-U-L-D-E-R, is the part of your body where your arm connects to the rest of your body. A wheel, W-H-E-E-L, is of course a round object, a circle that moves and allows cars and other vehicles to move. However, to put your shoulder to the wheel means to put a lot of effort into something, to put a lot of hard work into something in order to finish a task or a job. We have to get this project finished by 5 o'clock tonight. Let's put our shoulders to the wheel. Let's really work hard so we can do that. The phrase comes from the days when you didn't have cars or trains even, but rather what we would refer to as a wagon, W-A-G-O-N, or a cart, C-A-R-T. These would be vehicles that were pulled by some sort of animal, such as a horse. And if you were going down a certain area, and there was mud on the road, or there wasn't a road, and you were in mud, and you couldn't go forward, you might have to get out and put your body against the wheel, put your shoulder to the wheel, grab the wheel, and try to push the cart or the wagon, the vehicle, forward so that you could get out of the mud. That would require a lot of work. There is actually a reference to this expression, I believe, going back as far as Aesop's Fables, back in the days of the ancient Greeks. That's the concept behind the phrase, but it's used to mean to put a lot of effort into something or to work very hard at something. If you have a question or comment, you can email us. Our email address is ESLPOD@ESLPOD.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thank you for listening. Come back and listen to us again right here on The English Cafe.
ESL Podcast English Cafe was written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Say. This podcast is copyright 2015 by the Center for Educational Development.